That was Elton John with Rocket Man, and prior to that you heard a clip from Radiolab. I'm Tyler Hill, you're listening to Discovery on KAPU, and today we're talking about space. And actually earlier this week I had the chance to sit down with one of APU's resident space experts.
Okay, my name is Leslie Wickman. I'm the director of the Center for Research and Science here at Azusa Pacific. I got my undergraduate degree at Willamette University in political science. I did an internship at the State Department in Washington, D.C. my senior year and realized that I needed to get an advanced degree in order to get where I wanted to go in life. So I went on and got my master's degree in aero-astro engineering at Stanford and then my Ph.D. in human factors and biomechanics also at Stanford. I worked at Lockheed Martin in Northern California on the Hubble Space Telescope program, as well as the International Space Station program. And I worked at NASA Ames Research Center for my doctoral dissertation research on spacesuit design for the Moon and Mars exploration.
Not only has Leslie earned several degrees regarding space, but she's loved space from a very young age and has worked on some pretty major projects.
Well, I guess I should start at the very beginning. When I was a young child, my dad had a telescope, and we used to go out and watch look at the stars and the moon and the planets at night. And I think that's what really inspired my interest in space from a very early age. And then I took an astronomy class as an undergrad that kind of renewed that interest. And after I finished my graduate degrees and I was working at Lockheed, the people that I was working with designated me as their corporate astronaut. And I had been already actually supporting neutral buoyancy experiments and astronaut training exercises for the Hubble Space Telescope program.
And in case you're wondering what a corporate astronaut is,
the difference between a corporate astronaut and a NASA astronaut is that the NASA astronauts actually work for NASA. They're civil servants. And a corporate astronaut would work for a corporation. And so because Lockheed was the prime contractor on the Hubble Space Telescope project, they designated me as their astronaut because I knew the telescope really well. And so they had begun conversations with NASA about sending me up on either the Hubble telescope deployment mission when they launched it or on one of the repair missions that followed.
And that never ended up happening?
Or? Well, no. What ended up happening was that there were actually a bunch of things that happened. There were a couple of shuttle accidents, and in the wake of the shuttle accidents, NASA did not want to send up non-NASA employees. And so that put things on hold for a while. And then also Lockheed was going through a merger with Martin Marietta, and they were kind of unsure of what their future was going to look like, whether they were going to stay in human spaceflight programs or just go with more unmanned programs. And so I guess you could say that politics kind of got in the way. So I never did get to actually fly in space, or at least not yet.
We'll get to that not yet in a little bit, but first let's just talk about some of the intense training Leslie had to do as part of that program.
I went through high altitude physiology training, where they basically put you in a hypobaric chamber and they reduce the pressure to what it is at about 20,000 feet altitude, and then they take you off your oxygen mask to get you to experience the signs of hypoxia or low oxygen to your brain. And so I did that a couple, two, three different times.
And they do that so the astronauts can recognize hypoxia in dire situations and take steps to correct it.
Another part of the training involves flying on the KC-135 research aircraft, which is also affectionately known as the Vomit Comet. And the reason it's called the Vomit Comet is basically everybody that goes on it for the first time or two gets sick. And but the KC-135 is good for really quality simulation of weightlessness, and basically flies along straight and level, and then as it goes into a parabola, It pulls 2 G's going into it, and then you get about 20 seconds of weightlessness over the top of the parabola. And then as you pull out, you get 2 G's again, and then they go into another parabola. So they might do about 10 parabolas in a row and then turn around and do 10 more turn around again and do 10 more, etc. And the flights, depending on the weather and how good the air quality is in terms of lack of turbulence, they'll fly anywhere from like 20 to 40 parabolas in a flight.
In addition to the Vomit Comet, Leslie's also done zero gravity training underwater, and for that she actually got to wear a real spacesuit. And it turns out that the process of getting that spacesuit on is a little harder than you might expect.
To put on the spacesuit, you start with the liquid-cooled and ventilated garment, which is kind of like long underwear that's all one piece. So it's kind of like a onesie that zips up the front, and it's nylon, and it has tubes circulating water throughout the whole thing from head to toe. And then it's also got air tubes that come down your arms to wrists and down your legs to your feet to circulate cooling and drying air. And so you put that on first, and then the next step is to put the pants of the spacesuit on, which are big, heavy pants. It's got a bladder, a very heavy air pressurized bladder on the inside, and then on the outside it's got multiple layers of insulation to protect you from thermal changes as well as micrometeorite impacts. And the very outer layer is basically made out of Gore-Tex. It's like bulletproof, so that if you get hit by a micrometeorite, it won't penetrate the suit and cause a pressure leak. So you get your legs into the pants and down into the boots, which are part of the pants. It's the lower torso assembly. And then from there you stand up, you go over to the stand that is holding the hard upper torso, which is like the shirt of the spacesuit. And it's very heavy. It also, on the back of it, holds the portable life support system. And so that's held on a stand, and you kind of crawl up into it from below. And you're looking through the neck hole as you kind of wriggle into it and put your hands through the sleeves and your head through the neck ring. And once you're in place inside of that, that's the hard upper torso. You connect the cooling and airflow lines from the spacesuit life support system to the liquid cooled and ventilated garment, and make that connection, and then
seal the waist bearing
that connects the lower torso assembly to the hard upper torso. From there, the next step is to put on the helmet as well as the gloves. And so you put the helmet on over your head and seal the neck bearing, and then put the gloves on each hand and seal the wrist bearings there. And then at that point, the support people pressurize the spacesuit, and you're ready to go.
How much does the spacesuit weigh?
The spacesuit that is used, well, basically the spacesuit that's used in simulations is essentially the same as the one that's used in spaceflight. The only difference is that the life support system on the one that's used in the simulation does not contain all of the life support equipment. You run off of umbilicals for the simulations. And so the spacesuit without the life support system weighs about 150 pounds. Once you add on the life support system, that adds about another 100 pounds to it. So the whole thing weighs about 250 pounds. Once you get the spacesuit on, that's kind of just the beginning. Getting into the water tank, you either go on an elevator system, which some of the water tanks have that. In other cases, you actually walk down some stairs into the water. But once you get in the water, then the safety divers who are on scuba gear take control. And the first thing that they need to do is to make sure that you're neutrally buoyant. And so They'll basically put you in every imaginable position in the water, and they'll add weights on you to make sure that you don't move from that position. So they'll put you like horizontal and make sure that you've got adequate ballast on your chest and your back and your arms and your legs. And if you don't, and if you start to rotate from that position, they will balance out the weights. And so again, they put you in every position, upside down, right side up, on your side, in every position in between. And so that process, the very first time you go in to prepare for a test, takes about an hour. Well, maybe not quite an hour, but half an hour anyway. And so then from that point, the safety divers will swim you over to the work site, and you'll get set up. And typically you'll be in a portable foot restraint, so you basically put your boots of the spacesuit into these kind of horseshoe-like stirrups, and slide your heel to lock into to place in another little grooved piece that holds your feet in place. So that enables you to react loads while you're working, and otherwise you'll just basically, if you try to turn a wrench, it will, you know, your body will move the other direction. And so basically Newton's laws in action, you know, so for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. If you don't have something to react the loads against, it will just move your body instead of moving the tool.
But even after doing all that work to make your weight neutral, it's still not quite the same as true weightlessness.
In the water tank, even though the suit is neutrally buoyant, within the spacesuit, the gravity is still acting on your body. And so if you're upright in the spacesuit, it's like you're standing on the bottoms of your shoes, essentially. Or if you're horizontal in the water tank, like I was in one of our long tests, we had a test series that lasted 6 or 8 weeks. And for that, we were oriented horizontally in the water tank because we were building a large structure for the space station, and we had more distance horizontally in the water tank to work with than we did vertically. And so after lying in that position on the side of the suit that was toward the bottom of the pool, I ended up having bruises up and down my ribs just from being in the same position for a long period of time.
So remember earlier when Dr. Wickman said she hasn't been able to go to space yet?
There are a number of commercial missions that are actually being proposed right now by the private sector, and I've been approached by one of the organizations and asked if I would be interested in participating in one of the long-duration missions to Mars. What it would be a flyby mission of Mars, basically launching from Earth, going out and around Mars, and coming back, and it would take about a year and a half. And the idea would be to kind of inspire the next generation of rocket scientists, if you will, to kind of dream big. It would be a mission that would take humans much farther from Earth than ever before. We've already sent robotic missions to Mars, and so we know the orbital mechanics issues in terms of how to actually get spacecraft to and from Mars. And so the next logical step really is to go to Mars. And so, we could keep people on the space station in low Earth orbit for longer periods of time. But in terms of kind of making our mark in history, this is kind of the next big step.
And by big, she means big. Going to Mars is no small undertaking. In fact, it's somewhat of a logistical... All right, let me try that again. A logistical nightmare.
Well, one of the big issues is how to keep astronauts safe and healthy over really long durations in space. And so far, our experience has been on the space station, and the longest that anyone has been in space has been just over a year. And so this mission would take that record quite a bit farther. So it would be about 500 days. And so that would extend the current record by, 140 days or so. Some of the problems of keeping humans healthy over long-duration space flight are things like cardiovascular deconditioning. The heart doesn't have to work as hard in zero gravity because it's not having to pump blood back to your upper body against gravity. So your heart muscle deconditions. You also have muscular atrophy, especially in the muscles that you use to support your skeleton in normal 1G, such as the postural muscles in your back and your lower body leg muscles for walking. And so you have the muscular atrophy, and also you have bone demineralization. You end up getting what is known as zero gravity induced osteoporosis, where your bone loses density. And because your skeleton is basically not having to support the same amount of loads as you do on Earth. In general, the main problem is coming back and getting readjusted to Earth's gravity. And then the other problem that is really a big deal is radiation exposure, because in spaceflight, you're not protected by the Earth's atmosphere or by the Earth's magnetic field. And so you're dosage of radiation is much higher. And so all those problems have to be addressed in order to keep humans healthy during spaceflight.
But physical health isn't the only logistical problem being faced by scientists who are at work on this project.
So if you think about it, everything that we've done so far in space has been relatively close to the Earth. You know, both the space station and the moon are really close to the Earth. In fact, you can get to the space station in about, an hour and a half, 2 hours. To get to the moon, we're talking, 2 to 3 days. And so both of those destinations are within really easy reach of the Earth. So if there are any problems that happen on either one of those platforms, getting to and from is relatively quick. You won't have that luxury on a Mars mission. It's basically going to take, the round trip is about 500 days. And so even, to get people out to Mars, we're talking about half of that time, so 250 days. So if you have a problem, you cannot get help from Earth in a timely manner. And so that whole part of the mission makes it a lot more challenging in terms of logistics. And so whereas on the space station, we have resupply missions from the Earth to bring water and food and other supplies on a regular basis, we won't have that luxury on this Mars mission. And so you basically have to take everything with you that you possibly need in a relatively small space and be able to recycle materials as much as possible. And so on the space station, we've learned a lot actually about recycling water. And so essentially all the water on space station is recycled from urine to drinking water. So we'll be able to use that type of technology on this mission. But you think about the amount of food that people need for 500 days, and it's probably going to necessitate growing some food en route and being able to recycle waste products and, harvest new food. So that's a big challenge. That's something that we really haven't had to do on space station. We haven't had to do that in spaceflight because, number one, our missions are relatively short, and number two, we're within easy reach of resupply missions from Earth. So that's going to be probably one of the biggest challenges, that and keeping astronauts healthy en route. In terms of providing the food, there's been a lot of work that's been done in the area of hydroponics and aquaponics, which is essentially growing food with kind of the minimal amount of nutrients required. So instead of having soil, you basically have a solution of water with the basic nutrients that the plants need. And so probably we'll have to do some of that. Since we'll already be recycling water, there'll probably be a lot of freeze-dried and reconstitutable foods that'll be taken along.
And on top of all that is the fact that these astronauts will be stuck in an extremely confined space with one other person for over 500 days.
So one of the issues of being in a very small space capsule for a long period of time with one other person is you're going to be isolated from home and the Earth environment that you're familiar with, and confined to a very small volume with one other person. And so obviously the two people that will be going need to be very highly compatible with each other. And another way, though, that that they're going to try to address this is the idea of taking some sort of an inflatable structure along with them. So once they get outside of Earth's orbit, they'd be able to deploy this very large inflatable structure that can be pressurized, and then the crew can go into that area to kind of probably do things like exercise and, you know, just have some more personal space, just to kind of bring the concept down to Earth in a sense.
No pun intended.
The size of the space capsule is probably going to be roughly the size of a family camper that would go on the back of a pickup truck. So that kind of gives you an idea of the amount of volume that you'd have inside. The inflatable, on the other hand, has not really been determined exactly, but probably along the size of the interior of a Greyhound bus or something like that. So considerably more space, but still not, you know, unlimited.
So there are logistical problems, issues with personal space and sanity, challenges with food, and we're doing an okay job of overcoming those. But I've seen enough space movies that there's one problem hanging in the back of my mind. And that's the fact that if you're that far away and something goes wrong, you're all alone.
As foresightful as we try to be in terms of kind of thinking about every possible thing that could go wrong, you're right. I mean, it's kind of a limited amount of space, and the capsule that would be sent is certainly constrained in terms of the amount of weight that they can take with them. And there'll only be two people on this mission, and so, you know, certainly they'll be trained in basic first aid and, you know, try to take the sorts of pharmaceuticals and other preventative measures that we can respond to known problems. But if there is anything that's kind of unforeseen that comes up, you know, certainly if there were an emergency problem, I'm sure that what would probably happen is probably get a surgeon or whatever the type of medical issue was, a specialist, involved by communicating with the well person, the well crew member. However, there are communication delay problems when you're that far away from Earth that it's not real-time communication. You have to wait for the response. You have to send the message, and then it takes time to actually get back to Earth, and then the return message from Earth is also delayed. So it's not like you're having a phone conversation.
Depending on the distance between Earth and Mars caused by their different orbits, those transmissions could take anywhere from about 3 minutes to about 23 minutes. If my math is off, please feel free to write me a mean email, or even better, send it to the KAPU faculty sponsor, Dr. Brooke Van Dam. But that's enough about the challenges and negative aspects of space, because I also got to talk to Dr. Wickman about the serenity and beauty of being in space, and the change in perspective that people tend to experience after having gone to space.
One of the things that a lot of astronauts come back from space with is this sense that the Earth is an amazing place. Looking back at the Earth from space, you get this kind of more big picture view of it, and the idea that, you know, there's no borders. It's one planet in the midst of a very hostile cosmos in terms of, you know, the protection that it provides us, the life support that it provides us. And, you know, a lot of astronauts have reported kind of a spiritual experience in the sense that, wow, this is an amazing place that we live on. And you know, in contrast to the hostility of space, and, you know, the fact that whenever we leave the planet, we have to take all of our life support systems with us. And it's hard to keep people alive without, you know, the benefit of all the things that the Earth provides us. So there's a sense of wonder, certainly, that astronauts experience when going out in space, and just kind of the beauty of the Earth and the amazing intricacy of how it's all put together. And also just the vastness of space and how big our universe is, and really how small the Earth is in comparison. But small doesn't equate to insignificant, in, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I feel like, you know, when we look at the Earth, and again, the contrast between the Earth and the hostility of space around it, it seems to me that we see this place that was very specially created for us and designed to meet our needs. And to me, that equates to significance instead of smallness. One of my favorite verses is John 3:16. And in John 3:16, we read, "For God so loved the world," and the word "world" in the original Greek is actually cosmos. And I just love that, the fact that "for God so loved the cosmos," that is everything he made, the entire universe, that he sent his only son. And to me, that ties in really well with, you know, when we start talking about space and how big it is and the entire universe, that God loved the entire cosmos that he made, and he sent Christ to redeem the whole thing.
I'm going to end the segment with a sound clip from Dr. Carl Sagan. You may recognize his name. He was Bill Nye's mentor, and he also was mentioned earlier in the piece we heard from Radiolab. The clip might be a little cheesy. It has a little bit of classical music in the background, but I'm playing it for you because I just really like what Dr. Sagan has to say about the vastness of space and the beauty and specialness of Earth despite its smallness. The speech you're about to hear was inspired by a picture taken by Voyager 1 on Valentine's Day in 1990 as it left our planetary neighborhood. Dr. Sagan suggested it be turned around for one last look at its home planet, which at that point was 4 billion miles away and just over 1/10 of a pixel in size. If you want to see the picture, Google image search pale blue dot. You should find it pretty easily.
From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors, so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings. How eager they are to kill one another. How fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.
Thanks to Dr. Leslie Wickman for her time and help and for allowing me to interview her, and thank you for listening. I'm Tyler Hill, and this is Discovery on KAPU.